Although subject never had romantic feelings toward me, it appears she overheard the conversation between Ben and me after our egress from the karaoke bar, and therefore that subject was forcing me either to admit liking her or to lie when she inquired as to what Ben had said. Further investigation is required to discover her motives. Investigation. Chapter 30. I knew that Lily liked Sam, the football player, not me. I got that. But what I didn't know was why she called me out that night in her apartment, forcing me to lie about my conversation with Ben. I was also curious whether she knew that I was lying, and whether she knew I liked her during all of college, not just freshman year when we were going on coffee dates. Up until this time, all the girls I had investigated in this study had been from my hometown, so I was able to connect with them face-to-face while I was home for the holidays. But I knew Lily from college, and she lived a few states away now, so I tracked her down on Facebook and wrote her this message. To Lily. From Josh. Lily, what's up? Hope you are well. So, I'm doing this life project thingy to seek closure and forgiveness. Whoa, is it me or did this message just get weird? Okay, so, one night senior year at William & Mary, we were all standing outside the hospitality house. My friend Ben, who was sort of drunk, pointed at you and whispered very loudly to me, "Dude, it's your girl." And I was like, "Shut up, she can hear you." A few weeks later, I was hanging out at your apartment at King & Queen, and you called me out on it. "What did your friend say to you in front of Hospitality House?" you asked. This put me in an awkward position. I had basically had a crush on you for all 4 years of college. But after freshman year, I tried to keep this a secret from you and your friends since we ran in the same circles and I didn't want to make things uncomfortable for you. Perhaps you suspected this all along, or perhaps this is the first you've heard of it. Anyway, obviously Ben had been referring to my crush on you, but I couldn't tell you that, so I lied and told you something about him forgetting his ID. I'm not a fan of lying, so first, I wanted to ask your forgiveness. Second, I wanted to ask if you remember the incident, and if so, did you actually hear what Ben said at the hospitality house? Did you know I was lying? All these years, I've wondered if you did. Anyway, I know this is a very, very strange message, so feel free to just delete it. But if you would like to reply with any insight, large or small, into what you remember of that conversation, I would be most grateful for the emotional closure. Cheers, Josh. I held my breath for a couple days while I waited to see if she would respond. Footnote, that's just a figure of speech, otherwise I'd be dead. Just saying. Anyway, one night I logged on to Facebook and there it was. To Josh. From Lily. Josh, it's so good to hear from you. Now, as for this lie you say you told me, I can't say I remember the incident, but I am flattered. Ah, college. And of course I forgive you. No worries at all. Glad you're doing well. Lily. To paraphrase Elie Wiesel, in relationships, the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference, having no feelings at all, not caring either way. Hate, at least, requires a foundation of emotional involvement with the relationship. Which is not to say that Lily hated me or that she had complete apathy toward me, but I had to admit, it sort of stung to learn that not only was that conversation about Ben not a big deal to her, She didn't even remember it. That was how little it mattered to her. It was, for me, this big watershed moment in my life, a defining conversation in Lily's and my admittedly one-sided relationship. But for her, it didn't even make enough of an impression that the memory was worth saving. But I knew I shouldn't be surprised. She liked the other guy, not me. And though her reply on Facebook wasn't the insightful answer I was hoping for, she did give me an answer. That's the thing about life. Just because we don't get the answers we're hoping for doesn't mean they aren't answers nonetheless. Sasha Wright. Background. Chapter 31. Can I ask you a question?
Sure,
said the tall blonde girl. Why are you wearing a crown right now? I asked. Oh, that. Her eyes darted upward as if she could see through her forehead to the tiara that was perched there. I have to wear it whenever I'm on official business. As a general rule, I did not walk up to pretty girls and start talking to them like this. The summer after college, I had done some soul searching and decided I was fed up with dating. Too much rejection, too much trouble. Not that I didn't want a girlfriend anymore, just that it wasn't worth putting myself out there all the time. So when I had moved to Los Angeles to attend graduate school at the University of Southern California, I decided to take a more passive approach to dating. I was going to concentrate on becoming as cool as I possibly could. And then I would just let the girls come to me. That was my plan, at least. If I had learned anything from Lily, it was that you can't force something that isn't there. A girl either likes you or she doesn't. So now I was taking the Whole Foods approach to finding a girlfriend. I was going to let it happen organically. Most of my friends from college were living in Washington, D.C. now, but I was out in gloriously sunny but lonely Los Angeles pursuing a master's degree in communications. I was living in a 10-by-10-foot dorm room on campus at USC, a room about the size of a walk-in closet. There was a cafeteria connected to my dorm where I ate all my meals at a table by myself. As I walked across the palm tree-decorated campus to class each day, I watched the pretty girls pass me on the sidewalk without ever trying to talk to any of them. If they were interested, they would talk to me, I figured. But at the moment I met Sasha, I happened to be in North Dakota, which is kind of the opposite of Los Angeles. No beaches, no warm sun, no overcrowding. There aren't as many beautiful people as in LA either, which is what made this girl with the crown stand out even more. Official business, huh? I said. Are you, like, a queen of an obscure nation where they speak English with American accents? Yes. It's called North Dakota. And actually, if you listen carefully, we have our own accent up here. You're Miss North Dakota, I said, realizing who she was. And you're Josh. Nice to meet you. I'm Sasha. She held out her hand and I shook it. How did you... I saw you speak earlier, she interrupted. Nice presentation. You're very funny. Full disclosure, I'm not as funny in real life. Well, I don't see any other guys my age talking to me right now, so I'll just have to settle for an unamusing conversation with you. It was true. There weren't any other boys her age talking to her, or, for that matter, in this entire hotel ballroom. We were at a middle school leadership conference. My motivational speaking career had started taking off while I was in grad school, and I was at the conference as the keynote speaker. I had started giving speeches while I was in high school, and by the time I was ski racing, I was getting paid for it. So during my years as a ski racer, I gave a few speeches a year to fund my training. Anyway, now that I was in grad school, I was thinking I might want to make speaking my full-time profession, especially if the job gave me the chance to meet girls like Sasha. She had presented a workshop on bullying, according to what I'd read in the program. This was the final night of the conference, and the 500 middle school attendees were grinding merrily on one another on the dance floor in the center of the room. Sasha and I were planted firmly against the wall, watching the spectacle from a safe distance and speaking loudly enough that we could hear each other over the music. "So, how come you aren't dancing?" I asked.
"I could ask you the same question."
"They're all minors. I'm not trying to end up in one of your North Dakota jails." She was tall, blonde, and 100% bombshell. The regally formal tiara on her head was mismatched with the casual chic of her outfit. A light blue baby doll t-shirt, skinny jeans, and magenta heels. "Well, the truth is..." She leaned her head a little closer to mine and lowered her voice.
"I don't dance."
I raised my eyebrows. She continued reluctantly.
"In fact, this is the first real dance I've ever been to."
"You usually attend fake dances?"
"Basically, I was homeschooled," she said.
"Oh, you're one of those." She frowned.
"Yeah, I guess I am."
"I'm kidding. I was homeschooled too." She grabbed both of my hands and her heels bounced off the floor with excitement. Maybe she could dance better than she thought.
"You were?"
"Until high school."
"Gee whiz. I was homeschooled until college."
"That's crazy," I said. "And may I say, I've never heard someone use the term gee whiz if they weren't being sarcastic." Just then, the song changed.
"Oh, I love this one," she said.
It was California Love by Tupac. Fun fact, I live in Los Angeles, and in California, we sing this in place of the national anthem. She looked horrified.
"Really?"
"No, not really. You need to get out of your state more." The first verse began, and she started rapping along, word for word, pumping an open palm with the beat. I said, "I thought you said you didn't dance."
"I'm not dancing. I'm rapping."
"What's the difference?"
Seriously. Like, think about it. Tupac doesn't dance. He raps."
"Didn't dance."
"What?"
"Didn't dance. Past tense. He's dead." She laughed.
"Oh, you're one of those."
"One of what's?"
"Those people who think Tupac is dead? Haven't you read his lyrics? His posthumous albums reference Bill Clinton, who was elected years after Tupac was supposedly murdered, excuse me, assassinated."
"You're the only homeschooler I've ever met who studies Tupac lyrics."
"I bet I'm also the only homeschooler you've ever met who's a Miss America contestant. Perhaps you noticed the crown?"
"Yes, as a matter of fact."
"It is somewhat conspicuous."
"And very official business-looking." She motioned with her head, so her tiara pointed toward the back of the room.
"Let's go get some snacks," she suggested.
I followed her. I would have followed her across the border to Canada. She piled a little snack plate high with food.
"Most pageant girls are always like..."
She adjusted her voice to a whiny, nasally pitch.
"OMG, I can't eat any carbs or I'll get fat."
I've found that whenever a girl uses the word fat in a sentence, it's probably a trick of some sort, and the safest strategy is to say nothing, so I remain silent. "Anyway," she said, switching back to her normal Sasha voice,
"I'm like, screw that, I'm hungry."
I nodded and said nothing in case this was also a trick.
"So, how long are you in North Dakota?" she asked.
She did indeed have a slight accent, pronouncing the name of her state like North Dakota. "Just until tomorrow."
"When do you roll out?"
"Flight leaves at 6 a.m., I said. She grimaced. "I know, right? Too early," I said.
"No, too soon."
The next morning, when I took a taxi to the airport, it was both pre-dawn and sub-zero,
a highly unpleasant intersection of elements that sucks the life directly out of your soul. At the top of the escalator just before airport security, I found Sasha sitting on a bench. She was wearing sweatpants, a hoodie, and thick framed retro glasses. Her hair was pulled back in a loose ponytail. She was gorgeous. She stood, smiling. When you see someone unexpectedly, and it is clear that that person is there to surprise you, it's tough to conjure the right words. Or, for that matter, to conjure any words at all. You're just so confused. "What are you doing here?" I managed to say. "I came to tell you goodbye." "It's very early." "I stayed up all night."
"You do that normally?"
"Only when I want to make sure I'm up very early."
There was a pause. "So where's the crown?" I asked.
"This isn't official business."
I hoped it wasn't business at all. I hoped it was personal. I mean, it had to be, right? Why else would someone show up at the airport at such a soul-sucking hour? I said, "So it's nice to see you again. Also, I don't know, I was thinking I could get your... or maybe..."
"Josh, are you trying to ask for my number?"
"No. Well, yes. I mean, only if you want to give it to me."
She handed me a slip of paper on which her number had already been written. "Call me."
"I will," I said. "And actually, I'll be here for another speech in a couple weeks."
"Really?"
she asked, her face brightening.
"Yeah,"
I said. "We should hang out sometime. I mean, then. We should hang out then, at that time."
"I would like that."
"In the meantime, practice those dance moves," I said.
"Maybe I will."
"What's your talent, by the way?"
"You mean from Miss America?"
"Yeah."
"Stripping?"
My mouth dropped open slightly.
"I'm kidding."
"Oh."
"I sing opera."
"Opera, huh? I guess that's kind of like stripping."
"Kind of. They both involve funny costumes."
"I wouldn't know. I stay away."
"Too bad. You might like it. Opera, I mean."
"Yeah, that's the one I stay away from. And the other one, too. But I gotta go catch my flight. I'll talk to you soon."
Chapter 32. I felt my phone vibrate in my pocket, so I stopped in the middle of the sidewalk and pulled it out. Sasha. It had been a few weeks now since we met, and we talked almost every single day.
"Hey," I said.
"Hey, what are you up to?"
"I was just walking back from class."
"Was walking? Why'd you stop?"
"I can't walk and hold my phone at the same time. Well, I can, but then I have to use one hand to hold the phone and walk with one crutch, and it's pretty difficult, so, you know."
"Oh, right," she said.
I liked that she had to be reminded I had one leg and was on crutches. How that was not the first thing she saw when she imagined me. It was different for the students who were passing me on the sidewalk as I stood there talking on my phone. All they saw was the missing leg. They would take quick glances and then look away, torn between the universal instinct to examine that which is different and the learned social behavior that it's rude to stare. Sasha's voice on the phone interrupted my thoughts.
"If you don't mind my asking, how come you don't wear your prosthesis anymore? In your speech, you talked about it, but I never saw you wear it."
"Oh, I have nerve problems, vestigial pain from my amputation. The leg is really uncomfortable. I can't wear it anymore."
"You can't, I don't know, fix it?"
"No, I went to a bunch of doctors. The only thing they can do is a nerve blocking surgery on my spinal cord."
"Eek."
"Yeah, that's what I said. I get around fine on my crutches, so it's no big deal. In some ways, it's better. Socially, I mean."
"How's that?"
she asked. I usually didn't talk much about my amputation when I was getting to know a girl. I would prefer not to emphasize it. But I know people are always curious, Sasha included, and now I'd given her a window of opportunity to ask questions. Well, it's like before when I used to wear my leg, I explained, gesticulating now with my free hand, balancing on one leg, crutches hanging off my forearms. People saw me limping around on what they didn't know was a prosthesis, and they were always curious what was wrong with me. They would say stuff like, "Did you sprain your ankle?" And I had to be like, no, my leg was amputated. Awkward, she laughed. Exactly. So now it's really obvious. Like, right now, everyone on the sidewalk where I'm standing can see that I have one leg. But at least there's no question about what sort of disability I have. I'm not trying to disguise it with a fake leg or something. It's like, what you see is what you get.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's cool. But don't people treat you differently because you have one leg?
Of course, all the time. I get asked the weirdest questions.
That's how I feel being, you know, a pageant girl. Whenever I show up at an event with my tiara and the sash on, I can tell people have certain ideas about me.
Like what?
That I'm pretty, so I must be really dumb. That I'm blonde, so I must be an airhead. That I want world peace, but I don't really know what world peace is. All that stuff.
I feel like you can use that to your advantage.
How do you mean?
She asked. Like, people make assumptions about me because I have one leg, right? When they meet me, I mean. They figure I'm probably very shy, reserved, self-conscious, that I might be bitter about my situation. So it's like, if I act really confident and self-assured, it bowls people over. It's shocking. They're amazed by my charisma or something, but it's only because their expectations were so low in the first place. I feel like you can have that same effect.
Aw, you're saying you think I'm smarter than the average beauty queen?
Now you're just fishing for compliments. That semester, I also started traveling to North Dakota pretty often for speeches. I always thought about Kyle and his steel-toed boot, how I needed to bite the bullet and have a DTR with Sasha, tell her I liked her. For one thing, maybe she'd win Miss America. And if she did, I needed to make sure I was dating her before then, because once she had that national crown, she'd be way, way out of my league. But more importantly, we needed to have the talk for the reason you always need to have the talk. So things can move forward. So you can emerge from the muck of ambiguity into a mutually understood, solidified relationship. That's where the long distance thing was really an impediment, though, because you really don't want to have a DTR over the phone. That's a conversation you must have face to face. But during those brief hours when we'd be together in North Dakota, in between my speeches and her public appearances, the time was just so short. I couldn't bring myself to do it. It was like high school all over again. What I needed was a grand romantic gesture, a big display, a smash bang, knock her socks off with surprise that would either cause us to implode or to become boyfriend and girlfriend. Like a rooftop picnic. Like a canoeing date on a lake. Like a national beauty pageant.
Chapter 33. I was pretty sure Sasha was going to win Miss America. I just had a feeling. And I was also pretty sure she liked me. I had a feeling about that too. My idea was to bring these two feelings together in my grand gesture. Specifically, I would show up to surprise her at the pageant. Like when she surprised me at the airport, except in this case, after sunrise. In fact, it would not be enough for me to be merely in the audience at the pageant, just one of 7,000 anonymous faces. I needed access to her before she got on stage. But how? In the weeks leading up to the pageant, I didn't get to talk with her much on the phone.
She was spending all her time getting pedicures, manicures, and all the other types of cures available from the cosmetology industry. You would think she was a tribute in the Hunger Games or something. Not that she needed it, she was beautiful before. But Miss America has to be perfect. Meanwhile, after a great deal of planning and effort, I found my back door into the pageant. I made an arrangement with an organization that was one of the sponsors of Miss America. I would give a motivational speech at an event for this group. In exchange, they would get me a ticket to the pageant in Las Vegas. Not only that, they would also get me a ticket to a super ballin' VIP $2,000 a plate banquet the night before. A banquet, it should be noted, where all the pageant contestants would be in attendance. So I road-tripped across the desert from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, fantasizing the whole way about the look on Sasha's face when she saw me at this banquet, decked out in a tuxedo I had purchased on eBay for the occasion. She would be overcome by the pageantry of my grand gesture, by the affection and loyalty and sacrifice it all signaled. I mean, who could resist a boyfriend who would do all that for you? I wore my tuxedo on the drive to Las Vegas, all its parts with the exception of the final piece of the outfit, the bow tie. Let me back up and explain that I had decided to wear a real bow tie at this event, not the pre-tied clip-on variety I wore when I took Evelyn to prom. Before departing for my drive, I had studied several bow tie tutorials online, and I planned to put it on once I arrived at the casino. I walked into Planet Hollywood, the location of both the banquet and the pageant, on my crutches with my bow tie in my pocket. I was nervous. I could run into Sasha at any point now, I figured, and I really wanted our meeting to be perfect. I wanted to take her breath away. I wanted her to be so happy I had come to see her. I wanted her to say, "Gee whiz, you came all this way to cheer for me at the pageant? Holy smokes! Can I be your girlfriend, please?" I ducked into a men's room outside the ballroom where the banquet would be held. Standing in front of the mirror, I extracted the bow tie from my pocket and attempted to replicate the steps I had studied in those tutorials. But no luck. I quickly discovered that real bow ties, while they look very classy, very James Bond-like, are virtually impossible to tie. Or at least to tie perfectly. With every attempt I made, it always ended up looking crooked or lopsided or tilted at a 45-degree angle. I was getting frustrated. And sweaty. And worried. I was worried that this was taking too long and I was going to miss the whole banquet. I was going to miss Sasha. I was going to miss my chance with her. Or I would see her, but my bow tie would make me look like a clown and she would be all like, "No, you aren't quite classy enough for me, Mr. Lopsided Bow Tie." The real bow tie had seemed like such a cool idea. I had expected it would make me look so suave and sophisticated. Now I saw that this was a mistake. A big, fat, carb-bloated mistake. It just wasn't worth it. I had spent too much time trying to get it to look right, and it had not even been close to worth it. Next time I wore a tuxedo, I decided, I would revert to prom-style clip-on bow ties. They were oh so much easier to put on. About this time, one of the other banquet attendees walked in. He was also clad in a tuxedo, but his bow tie was already tied. I was jealous of its symmetry. I'm not sure what it is about having one leg that makes people want to comment on it. But for some reason, my disability gives many individuals permission in their own minds to say whatever they want, despite our being total strangers. And often what they say ends up being quite awkward, especially the questions they ask. I'll give you an example. One time, I was wearing my artificial leg, and I was talking to this girl about what it was made out of, how it worked, all that. She looked down at the prosthesis, and she was like, "Is the foot fake too?" I informed her about the amazing medical technology that had allowed doctors to attach my real foot to the end of my artificial leg. "Really?" she said. Let me clarify, this wasn't a child. This girl was in high school. So anyway, I was standing in the men's room getting very frustrated about how the real bow tie had not been worth all the trouble, and this gentleman walked in, and he said to me, "It looks like you do pretty well with that." Now, listener, I was currently so caught up in my bow tying experience that I assumed he was talking about my ability to tie a real bow tie, though he was, in fact, talking about my ability to navigate life with one leg. So I was like, "Well, thanks. I appreciate that." A few seconds later, this gentleman and I were both standing in front of the urinals. I want to remind you that I was thinking about my bow tie, about the real bow tie that just wasn't worth the trouble. And he was thinking about my life as an amputee. I said, staring at the wall above the urinal, "I tell you though, it's actually pretty difficult." I could see him nodding out of the corner of my eye. "Yeah, it looks like it would be pretty difficult." There was a pause. "To be honest," I confessed, "tonight I've been feeling like it's just not even worth it anymore." He blatantly broke the number one rule of social interaction at urinals, making direct eye contact with me, and exclaimed, "Son, it's always worth it. No matter what happens, it's always worth it." This guy is intense, I thought. I must look really good in a real bow tie after all. Footnote. It wasn't until a few weeks later that I was thinking about how strange that conversation was, and it dawned on me what a massive misunderstanding we'd had. That guy is probably still out there organizing candlelit prayer vigils for me. Anyway, back to our story. Maybe if I looked this good in a real bow tie, it would be good enough to impress Sasha. At the banquet, I was seated at a circular table with a bunch of people I didn't know. This wasn't particularly surprising, of course, since I didn't really know anyone at the event. I made small talk with my table neighbors, however, all the while waiting and watching for the pageant contestants to arrive. And arrive they did. As dessert was being served, the lights went down in the small ballroom. Conversation among the crowd quieted down. A tuxedoed guy with well-coiffed gray hair took the podium. He looked like a boxing promoter, like the "Let's Get Ready to Rumble" guy. In fact, he probably was the "Let's Get Ready to Rumble" guy. This was Vegas, after all. He asked us to please put our hands together for this year's Miss America contestants. And we did as instructed. Spotlights came on as the 52 girls, footnote, in answer to your question, DC and Puerto Rico, marched into the room wearing evening gowns and sashes embroidered with the names of their home state. As it happened, Miss North Dakota walked right by my table. We made brief eye contact, and then her head snapped back when she recognized me. She stepped out of line and let the other girls keep walking as she approached my table. I stood up and reached out for a hug that never quite materialized. All she said was, "I didn't know you were going to be here." There was no excitement in her voice, no gratitude, no happiness. She wasn't even smiling. This was not how I had imagined it. Not what I had planned. Not at all. I felt like I was falling, like I had lost my balance and I was dropping in slow motion to land hard on the grass beside a golf tee. I wanted it to be a surprise, I said eventually. She blinked a few times, like a flashbulb had gone off unexpectedly in front of her. She looked surprised all right, but not in a good way. Oh, okay, well, I have to go sit at my table. And then her tiara rose several inches as she returned to perfect posture and fell back into the procession of beauty queens, left hand planted on her hip, right hand sashaying with each step. I didn't see her again that night. I hoped she would at least text me, but she never did. I got a cheap room at a Motel 6 off the main strip that had a single lonely slot machine in the lobby. At the pageant the next day, I sat by myself and cheered extra loud for Sasha. Out of the 52 contestants, she was only one of two who wore a one-piece bathing suit instead of a bikini. Sasha was a homeschooler, I remembered, and though she did listen to gangsta rap, I suppose at heart, she was still a good Christian girl. So she stuck to her guns and kept things modest on stage. I had to respect her principled stand, though a part of me wished she'd sold out a little, showed off a little more skin. Not for me, for the judges, for the win. Because she didn't win. In fact, she didn't even make the top 15, so I never got to hear her sing opera. Oh well, I wouldn't have understood the words anyway. After the pageant ended, I walked around Vegas for a couple hours, hoping she would text or call to see if we could hang out, or at least thank me for coming. I walked up and down the entire length of the strip. I stepped inside a few of the casinos and watched retirees blowing their savings one slot machine pull at a time. I waved away hobo-looking dudes offering glossy postcards with scantily clad women. I stared silently for a really long time at the fountains in front of the Bellagio. But I never heard from Sasha. Not once. Nothing. So I drove back through the desert to Los Angeles, feeling angry, hurt, confused. How could I have been so inaccurate in my assessment of our relationship? I mean, I wasn't in high school anymore. I felt like my instincts had matured enough that I could usually tell when a girl liked me. And Sasha had always seemed interested. Really interested. She had come to see me at the airport when it was still dark outside. We'd talked on the phone constantly ever since. We'd hung out in North Dakota whenever I came into town, and always, it had seemed, we had a great time. Granted, we had never kissed, but our hugs had been lingering, and honestly, I thought we were practically boyfriend and girlfriend. Yet, when I came to surprise and support her on the most important day of her life, she hardly even noticed I was there. Not before the pageant, not after. I gave it a few more days. Maybe she was busy. Maybe she was bummed out about her loss. Maybe she had a bunch of formal gowns to pack up and ship home. Maybe she'd call me when she got back to North Dakota. Nope. I never heard anything from her. So I didn't call her either. I didn't text. But as the days turned into weeks and my final semester at USC finished up, I kept wondering, what happened? Where had I gone wrong? How had I misjudged our relationship so drastically? Hypothesis. Subject behavior at Miss America pageant suggests I misjudged her interest in me. But if she did not have interest in dating me, why did she spend so much time on the phone with me? Face-to-face interview is required to investigate. Investigation. Chapter 34. A few months after the Christmas when I tracked down the girls of my failed middle school and high school relationships, I happened to be in Sasha's home state of North Dakota for a speech. In fact, I was in her city. Her number was still on my phone, so I broke radio silence by sending her a text to ask if she wanted to have dinner while I was in town. And that's how I found myself at a booth with Sasha in a sushi place that had a little fountain in the middle of it. I was nervous. Our conversation was basically an act of verbal procrastination. Eventually, she asked, "So, you have a girlfriend?" "No. Do you have a boyfriend?" She shook her head, smiling, like that was a funny question. "No, no boyfriend." "Speaking of which..." She raised her eyebrows. I continued, "Remember when we were... I mean... Remember when we used to be... Remember..." This was not going well so far. "When I came to Las Vegas to the Miss America pageant?" "Of course." "That was a big deal for me."
"I bet. That banquet was $2,000 a plate."
I smiled. "Oh yeah, I got a free ticket."
"How?
This whole time you thought I paid $2,000 for it?"
"How'd you get it?"
"Doesn't matter now. Look, what I want to know is, how come you blew me off that night?"
"What?"
"You blew me off. You barely said a word to me."
"Josh, I was about to compete in Miss America."
"And I had just paid $2,000 to see you do it."
"I thought your ticket was free."
"It was, but you didn't know that."
"The pageant was the biggest day of my life. It was a whirlwind. I barely even talked to my parents."
Our waitress arrived with my seaweed salad. "So, how come you never called me afterward?"
"After what?"
"The pageant." She frowned.
"You mean, after I lost?"
"After you competed in Miss America."
"I was eliminated in the first round."
"So?
You were one of the top 52 girls in the country, in America. Josh, what did you place in the Paralympics?"
34th.
"And were you proud of that finish?"
I was silent.
"Were you?"
"I see your point.
Answer the question, please."
"No, I thought it was a pretty bad finish."
"But Josh, you were at the Paralympics. You were one of the top ski racers in the world."
"All right, all right, I understand."
"Do you?"
"I don't think you do, because that's why I didn't call you, if you must know.
You had paid all that money and traveled all that way to see me compete. I wanted you to see me win and wanted you to be my boyfriend. But I lost, and I was ashamed about that. I was embarrassed."
It was a lot to process. But above everything she had just said, blinking like a neon sign in Vegas, was a single word. Boyfriend.
"You liked me?" I asked. "Of course I liked you."
"So, why didn't you call me?"
"I could ask you the same question."
"I didn't call you because you blew me off. I thought you had started dating someone else or something."
"Well, you were wrong. But then it occurred to me. We could make things right.
Now that it was all out in the open, now that we were both single and sitting there together in this sushi restaurant..."
"Maybe it's not too late," I said. "No, it is."
"But why? Just because we live far apart?"
"Josh, we could come visit each other." "Josh, Sasha, we could make this work. Josh!"
"What?" She looked down at the table silently.
"What?"
I said again. She kept her gaze fixed. I followed it down to her hand, where I noticed for the first time a sparkling diamond ring. I blinked a few times.
"I thought you said you don't have a boyfriend," I said softly. "I don't. I have a fiancé."
"Oh, well, congratulations," I said unconvincingly. "When did you meet?"
"3 months ago,"
We got engaged 6 weeks later. I didn't say anything, but I guess my surprise was written all over my face.
When you know, you know, she said. You just have to find the right person.
I wouldn't know.
Results of investigation. Chapter 35.
I went back to my hotel room and lay on the bed and stared at the ceiling. Sasha was the final girl on my list, so the scientific investigation was now complete. Complete, but not insightful. I had no answer, no single unifying explanation as to why I could never find a girlfriend. I had found no fatal flaw in my personality or appearance like I had expected to. The investigation, I concluded, had been a complete failure. Some months went by. One night, I went to see a movie by myself. Near the end, one of the characters lost a limb, which happens in movies all the time, right? No big deal. The lights came up, and I walked out to my car and sat down in the driver's seat. Then I started to breathe all weird. Oxygen came in short gasps. I thought about the character in that movie. And then I was thinking about the little boy I had once been. The boy who had lost a limb of his own. And I felt incredibly sorry for him. I wished I could reach back through time and hold his hand, comfort him in some way. I felt such grief over his life, over my life. A little gasp came out of my mouth, and then I was crying. I thought, why am I crying? This doesn't make sense. My amputation was so long ago. I am over it. I have accepted it and moved on with my life. Right? And that's when I realized the real reason, the actual reason I had set out on my scientific investigation in the first place. I wanted to find an explanation, any explanation at all other than the obvious one. I'd always been the guy who had overcome his amputation. I mean, I went to the Paralympics. I had been an elite athlete, a world-ranked ski racer. I had never used my disability as an excuse for anything. That just wasn't the kind of person I was. So I had not wanted to blame it for my lack of success with girls either. And if I was honest with myself, this was why I had really begun the investigation. I had hoped the girls I interviewed would tell me that I had been too nerdy or too serious or too silly or too anything, really. In fact, I would have even considered my investigation successful if one or two of the girls had told me they didn't want to date me because I was an amputee. At least that would allow me to say to myself, see, there is a problem. And the problem is with these girls being too shallow to date a guy with a disability. In other words, the problem is with them and their psychological shortcomings, not with me and mine. But of course, no girls had told me that. The truth was, I was the one who had a problem with my disability. Sitting there in that parking lot crying, I finally admitted to myself that I was deeply and painfully insecure about it. That was why I never tried to talk to Liza Taylor after the pumpkin shoe relay incident. That was why I was too scared to kiss Francesca at the waterfall. That was why I had never told Evelyn my true feelings about her. And that was why I had lost my nerve with Sasha and stopped calling her after the pageant. Because I was insecure about having one leg. It made me doubt myself. It made me feel inferior. I had always known this deep down, but I had not wanted to admit that there was an element of my disability I had yet to overcome. So I concocted this investigation to find some other explanation on which to place blame. And for this reason, my hypotheses had all been flawed from the beginning. The problem had not been with the girls, and the problem had not been with some characteristic of mine. The problem had been with my believing there was a problem. It had been with my believing that the way my body was shaped disqualified me from having a romantic relationship. It was not the shape of my body, as it turned out, but my insecurities about that shape that had kept me single. Ashley Samsonite. 11 months later. It was Saturday night, and I was out with my college friends. My brother Matt was also in town, visiting his girlfriend who lived here in D.C. We were dancing it up at a place called Local 16, a relatively classy restaurant located in a historic 3-story row house on U Street. At night, they cleared away the tables upstairs, brought in a DJ, and lowered the lights, and the space turned into a small, sweaty, kinetic dance floor. After a while of dancing slash jumping slash flailing with my crew, this girl came up to me and asked me about my tie. I wear ties for this exact purpose. Not to try to look good, but because they can be a good conversation starter. They give girls an excuse to talk to you. So while we were standing there talking about my tie and whatnot, this girl with platinum blonde hair and a silver spaghetti strap dress walks up to me from the other direction and says, "You're awesome." Girl number two was drop-dead gorgeous, absolutely stunning. And she just walked up to initiate conversation with me. How often does that happen? Like, never. This was a once-in-a-lifetime kind of opportunity. But being the gentleman that I am, I felt I owed chronological preference to girl number one. I couldn't just blow her off and start talking to the blonde simply because I preferred the way she looked. That's not how my mother raised me, you know? So I gave a terse thanks over my shoulder to girl number two and then turned my back on her to continue discussing the fascinating history of my tie with girl number one. Girl number two walked away, disappearing from my life for what I assumed would be forever. Eventually, I broke free from the conversation with girl number one, who, as it turned out, had a boyfriend. So why was she even asking about my tie in the first place? And returned to dancing with my crew. I told them the story, yelling over the music. Girl number two, the hot blonde, a sad missed opportunity. Just my luck. After a few songs, I noticed that not 3 feet in front of me was the back of a blonde head. I turned to Matt. "Hey, isn't that the girl who said I was awesome earlier?" Matt agreed that, "Yeah, dude, it was totally her." The problem was that now there was a guy hitting on her. And as soon as she shut him down and sent him walking away with his head hanging, another guy jumped in to fill his place. I knew she already thought I was awesome. The door was open for me to talk to her. The problem was the continuous stream of bros trying to hit on her. And then there was this moment when she was gloriously alone, just standing there dancing by herself. I reached out to tap her on the shoulder, but reflexively pulled my hand back before it touched. I had just witnessed this girl shutting down 5 guys in a row. Who cared if she thought I was awesome? She was clearly in the zone, the rejection zone, demolishing egos with ruthless efficiency. No, This was no time to back down. I'd come too far. I'd learned too much. About girls. About myself. I wouldn't miss this one. I tapped her on the shoulder. She turned around, eyebrows raised.
Aren't you the girl who said I was awesome earlier?
Yeah, I am, she said, smiling. I felt a warm tingle all over my body. She was clearly happy to be talking to me again. Now, all I had to do was chat with her for a few minutes, dance with her for a little while, and she would offer me her number, and at the end of the night, this would be the beginning of, "We're leaving." The voice came from another girl, a tall brunette, whose tone communicated, "My ex-boyfriend showed up here," or, "I just saw another girl wearing the same dress as me," or some other such female night-ruining disaster.
"Oh, all right," said the blonde.
"Wait, you're leaving right now?" I asked.
"Yeah," she said. "Sorry."
She did look genuinely sorry, but she was being pulled on the wrist by the girl who was not having fun. She got dragged a few steps away and started to disappear into the crowd.
"Wait," I called. "What's your name? I'll Facebook you."
Notice, not a yes or no question, so she couldn't reject it. She smiled. "Ashley Samsonite."
"All right, got it. I'll friend you, okay?"
She nodded, and then she was gone. I turned to Brad. "You remember Ashley. I'll remember Samsonite." His forehead wrinkled.
"What?"
"Ashley, just remember that name, all right?"
"Ashley. Got it."
I spent the rest of the evening repeating her last name over and over in my mind so I wouldn't forget it. It was my only connection to her, the sole thread holding us together. Samsonite, Samsonite, Samsonite. When Brad and I got back to our apartment, I immediately logged on to Facebook, assuming there couldn't be more than a few Ashley Samsonites out there. Wrong. There were over 600 of them. The search results showed their profile pictures as unrecognizably tiny thumbnails. Plus, because of privacy settings, I couldn't see where most of them lived, so I was not able to simply sort by who resided in DC. I spent the next 2 hours scrolling through the search results and friending every single Ashley Samsonite who was blonde and either lived in DC or did not specify a hometown. It was 3 a.m. when I reached the end of the list, having friended around 30 girls with identical names. I had waited too long to meet this girl. I was not going to lose her now. When I woke up the next morning, I signed into Facebook and found that 5 Ashley Samsonites had accepted my friend request. 5. This made me wonder, assuming that one of them was the real Ashley Samsonite, who were these other 4 girls? They get a friend request from some random guy with one leg and say, "Sure, I'll be friends with him." Also, when the real Ashley saw my friend request and looked at my profile, presumably she saw on my timeline and activity feed something like this. "Josh Sundquist is now friends with Ashley Samsonite. Josh Sundquist is now friends with Ashley Samsonite. Josh Sundquist is now friends with Ashley Samsonite." Awkward. Anyway, I checked out the 5 Ashley Samsonites who had accepted my friendship. Now that I was friends with them and I could see their photos in full size, I was able to pick out the one I had met the previous night. So I sent her a message about how we should, you know, hang out sometime. One night, a few months and many perfect dates later, she agreed to let me be her boyfriend. And just like that, I had a girlfriend. I looked at myself later that night in the mirror and noticed, somewhat to my surprise, that I looked pretty much the same as I did before. I was still the same person I had been all along. the person I'd always been inside, the one who was always worthy of a relationship, always worthy of love. Being an amputee doesn't make me a fraction of a person. The whole is greater than the sum of